corruption and the epic U.S. failure to control the COVID-19 pandemic.
If the United States had the same level of death that comparable countries did in the first year of the pandemic, we would have had 40% fewer deaths. Now, pause for a second and think about that figure. 40% fewer deaths. In that first year, we had 400,000 to 500,000 deaths, perhaps a lot more because of underreporting. But if we go with that 40% figure, what we recognize is that hundreds of thousands of people died unnecessarily. Millions of people were infected unnecessarily. And tens of millions of people suffered economic harm unnecessarily. And so these are startling figures. It's overwhelming numbers. And it's one of the core base arguments for why there has to be some measure of accountability.
That's John Nichols. We spend the hour with him talking about his latest book, Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers. This is Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As of March 15th, as we produce this episode of Writer's Voice, over 965,000 Americans have died of COVID-19. That's according to the official count, but it's almost certainly an undercount. If you go by the CDC's reckoning of excess deaths that could be attributed to COVID, another 500,000 deaths would be added to the official toll. Meanwhile, the pandemic has been very, very good for the nation's billionaires. They've increased their already astronomical wealth by 70%. They've collectively accrued an extra $2.1 trillion, with a T, in a little more than a year, according to a report from October 2021. And the profits of pharmaceutical company and COVID vaccine maker Pfizer doubled during the pandemic. It's long been apparent that corruption kills. It makes any sort of effective response to crisis impossible, because the common good is tossed in favor of the individual profits of the richest, most powerful people and corporations. The link between corruption on a systemic and individual level and the outsized toll of the pandemic on the U.S. is explored in John Nichols' latest book, Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers, subtitle, Accountability for Those Who Caused the Crisis. From Mike Pence to Andrew Cuomo, Mitch McConnell to his wife, Trump Cabinet Secretary Elaine Chao, and from Amazon to Pfizer, Nichols details the callous decisions of powerful people that resulted in tens of thousands of unnecessary deaths, hundreds of thousands of disabled people, and millions of people grieving their lost family members. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. He's the author of numerous books, including The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, which was the last book of his we spoke with him about, before Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers. John Nichols, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It's a great honor to be with you. I love this show.
Well, thank you. And I love this new book of yours, Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers. It's a blistering indictment of those who are responsible for aiding and profiting off a virus that's killed close to a million people and counting, and the system that enabled them. And this whole dynamic of individuals and the system, I think, is what makes this book so powerful. And let's start with an individual who's not a coronavirus criminal. You begin the book with a story of Briggs and Stratton factory worker Michael Jackson in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Tell us about him.
Well, I'm so glad you focused on that, Francesca, because one of the things that I tried to do with this book was to obviously identify the bad players, But I wanted to put it all in perspective. I wanted people to understand that we demand accountability, not just for the sake of going after a president or a cabinet member or a billionaire or a pharmaceutical CEO. We demand it because there was tremendous human loss. There was tremendous pain over the last 2 years, and much of that continues. And so in each chapter, I try to focus on individuals whose lives were lost and who I would argue in most cases did not need to die. And Mike Jackson is the first of these individuals I focus on. And he was, as you note, a factory worker at Briggs & Stratton in a suburb of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He did work that was deemed essential. Now, even there, that's a bit absurd because he was making lawn care equipment. And so we know that in the earlier stages of the pandemic, the definition of essential work was often manipulated by corporations because they wanted to keep producing their goods. But be that as it may, he had a job. And at a time when a lot of folks were losing their jobs, he was certainly very clear about wanting to keep his work and keep his paycheck. He had a large family. And so he showed up at work every day. He was active in his union, and he and his fellow workers at the plant clearly and early identified that conditions were not safe. They said, look, you know, we don't have the protective gear that we need. We don't have the screens between workers, so we're not facing one another and potentially coughing on one another, et cetera. And the company was very slow to respond. They also were raising their concerns at a time when the federal government was very slow to respond, not doing nearly as much as they should have or needed to be doing as regards the regulation of workplaces. Long story short, Mike Jackson got sick. He initially got sick and left work one day, felt a little bit better, still not totally well, but came back to work because he was being told that's what you need to do and you need to show up. And he was obviously concerned about losing his paycheck. In short order, he collapsed at his machine. He was ultimately taken to a hospital and he died. And I tell his story in part because we want to humanize the reality of the pandemic, but also because of something remarkable that happened after his death. And that was that his fellow workers did not let it go. They continued to highlight his death and to use it to illustrate the irresponsibility of corporations and of government regulators in a pandemic moment. And in particular, they told his story again and again as individuals and through groups like Voces de la Frontera, which represents immigrant workers and hourly workers in the Milwaukee area. They focused on one big fight, which is liability. And there was an attempt by a lot of political figures to impose a liability shield that prevented families and individuals from suing corporations that ill-served them during the pandemic. And what the activists said was, this is absurd. You know, in a case of someone like Mike Jackson, he could have been protected, but he wasn't protected. And we need to make changes that allow that to happen. And we also need to assure that those who fail to protect workers are held to account.
Yeah, and this word liability, we are going to discuss it a number of times in this book. It comes up again and again, and immunity from liability. But before we do that, I'd like you to talk a little bit more about the toll and, you know, kind of the alternate universe that if the OSHA regulations had been followed, if workers had been protected, if we had had a robust response to the pandemic, how many fewer Americans might have died?
But, you know, we actually have some pretty good data on that. And I cite it in the book and have talked about a lot in interviews regarding the book. The Lancet, a British medical journal that's very highly regarded, convened a panel to look at disparities between the quality of healthcare and services in the United States versus other countries. And they were looking broadly at this issue, but they specifically focused in on COVID. And what they determined was that if the United States had had the same level of death that comparable countries did in the first year of the pandemic, we would have had 40% fewer deaths. Now, pause for a second and think about that figure. 40% fewer deaths. In that first year, we had 400,000 to 500,000 deaths, perhaps a lot more because of underreporting. But if we go with that 40% figure, what we recognize is that hundreds of thousands of people died unnecessarily. Millions of people were infected unnecessarily. And tens of millions of people suffered economic harm unnecessarily. And so these are startling figures. It's overwhelming numbers. And it's one of the core base arguments for why there has to be some measure of accountability.
Yeah, and just to point out that's a comparison to the other G7 countries who, you know, one can argue they didn't have necessarily the most perfect response either.
Francesca, this was a global pandemic. It hit a lot of people hard. And as you well know, if you were watching television in March of 2020, we were seeing reports from Italy and from other countries around the world of really daunting, overwhelming challenges. But the interesting thing is that as those challenges became clear, countries around the world responded effectively. They said, look, we have to lock down. We have to wear masks. We have to have all sorts of interventions that assure that lives are saved. We have to massively up spending on healthcare and expand our services to people in their homes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. End result was that you don't take the measure in the first few weeks. You take the measure a year in or 2 years in. And what is revealed is that while other countries got their acts together, under Donald Trump in the United States, there was an absolute failure to get the act together. In fact, there was denial of the crisis and lying to the American people, which made a bad situation dramatically worse.
And a whole lot of pandemic profiteering as well. You know, this book, as I said before, talks about individuals. It talks about the system. Talk about Trump's response, not as just a problem of Trump and the Trump administration, but as the apotheosis of the free market model run amok.
Well, you wisely focus in that direction, because as I say in the book, this problem didn't start with Donald Trump. Donald Trump, in many ways, is the completion of, or let us hope the completion of, an arc of impunity in American politics, where we have for decades let political figures get off the hook when they fail to serve the American people in moments of crisis and moments of challenge, and also where we have allowed and even, you know, kind of respected, if I put quotation marks around that word, political players who look at a difficult circumstance and ask as their first question, how can I help myself politically? How can I advance my own political interests? And so we live in a country where, you know, Richard Nixon didn't get impeached for Watergate. He flew off to San Clemente and started rehabilitating his reputation. Ronald Reagan didn't get impeached and removed for Iran-Contra. You know, he flew home to California as well. George Bush and Dick Cheney were not held to account for their lies as regards the Iraq War or for their role in crashing the global economy. They retired with pensions, and, you know, George Bush now paints paintings and, you know, trades mints with Michelle Obama. And so we live in a country where the message to our political elites is you can first and foremost look at your own political advantage when you make decisions about how to respond to great challenges. And that's exactly what Donald Trump did. In fact, the fascinating thing about Donald Trump is that he admitted it. In interviews in March of 2020 with Bob Woodward, he acknowledged that he was lying to the American people about the severity of the crisis because he didn't want them to get overly excited, overly concerned, overly angry. And why? Because it was an election year and he was afraid that this would harm what he was hoping for would be an economic recovery that would boost his reelection chances.
Right. This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking today with John Nichols about his new book, Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers. And now let's go to not the president, but the vice president, Mike Pence. Yeah. Mike Pence was put in charge of the coronavirus response. What were his qualifications for this role?
Well, he was uniquely unqualified for the role. As governor of Indiana, as I write about in the book, he terribly mismanaged a host of healthcare issues and challenges, and he often allowed ideology and politics to get in the way of doing what would save lives. And so his record on a host of issues was so incredibly daunting that healthcare specialists and public health specialists said, it, even from the beginning when Pence was put into this role, look, this is the wrong guy. He really does have a record of not, you know, handling situations like this well. In fact, of handling them in ways that cause more death, more disease, more challenges. And yet, of course, you know, Pence took on the role. Now, the incredible thing about it was that much of the media still, even then, and to some extent even now, treated Pence as kind of the adult in the room, someone who is a little bit more responsible for Trump or than Trump. And so there was a sense that putting him in charge of the commission, putting him in charge of the oversight of the pandemic would be a good thing. But the truth is that Pence lied just as aggressively as Trump did. He was just as irresponsible. And ultimately, and this is kind of the fascinating thing, as the pandemic surged and you know, went from, you know, relative easing to, you know, spikes in the amount of infection, spikes in the number of deaths, overwhelming situations for hospitals, Pence actually lost interest in the process. He stopped showing up at meetings. He, you know, didn't talk about it for weeks on end. And what you realize is that the person who was put in charge of handling our response frequently didn't even show up to do it. And when he did show up to do it, he often lied to us. Again, a case where, you know, if you just look at the record, if you just look at the reality, there's an incredibly powerful argument for accountability as regards Mike Trump.
Yeah, and it's just an emblematic of the utter disregard for governing that this administration and the GOP in general has. I mean, this is what's so shocking to me. They don't even pretend that they care about governing.
No, that's exactly right. And that comes out a lot in the chapter on Mitch McConnell. And this is one of the more incredible realities that I think got lost a little bit in media coverage of the pandemic. I think in part because the pandemic was so overwhelming. We were all worrying about our own challenges in our own lives, kids who couldn't go to school, people couldn't go to work, rearrangement of how we did everything, and also just the basic fear of the disease. But and at critical stages in the pandemic, Mitch McConnell intervened to prevent the response that was needed. Early in 2020, there was a pandemic relief bill that was passed with pretty strong bipartisan support. But it was clear very quickly that that was insufficient. So a second bill was passed by the House and went to the Senate. Mitch McConnell sat on that bill for months, you know, through the summer into the fall, at a time when it, if it had been passed quickly, it could have done an immense amount of good, actually preparing us to deal with the surges in the virus in the late fall and winter of 2020. And the amazing thing about it is he did that for the same reason that that many Republicans, and I'll point out some Democrats, you know, adjust their political sights. And that is because special interests wanted a liability shield that would prevent corporations from being held to account for deaths and spread of disease, for other challenges during the pandemic. The liability shield was not needed. Public health experts said it wasn't needed. Consumer experts said it wasn't needed. Lawyers said it wasn't needed, but corporations wanted it. And so Mitch McConnell, as a Republican leader of the Senate and his Republican allies in the Senate, delayed action on absolutely vital and necessary pandemic relief because they wanted to make sure that corporations were taken care of first.
Yeah. Manchin and Romney got into the act.
Yep.
So tell us about that. And I'm not sure here, I have my on my notes, there's an Orwellian term, Safe to Work Act. Was that theirs or was that Mitch McConnell?
As more of the McConnell. Well, look, there were, in that period, a number of bills put forward by different players, all of which had flaws within them, right? The initial piece of legislation that came out of the House was the right piece of legislation. When McConnell blocked action seeking this liability shield, you saw some so-called moderates like Manchin and Romney come forward with what they suggested was a compromise measure. And it had a narrower set of protections for corporations, but still sort of tried to bend to McConnell's demands. They really didn't get very far with it. It was pushed and pulled in a lot of different ways. And then it was interrupted, obviously, by the horrible surge in the pandemic in the late fall and winter of 2020. And so at that moment, the demands became so overwhelming for action that McConnell had to back down. But you are right. There was in this period, McConnell is a bad player. And then also people who, instead of calling him out and just saying, no, this is, you know, we can't do this your way, who tried to do the sort of quote unquote bipartisan compromise. And, you know, as we've learned during the last couple of years, invariably in situations like that, it may be a little better than what Mitch McConnell wanted, but it's not good enough for what the American people need.
Yeah, exactly. Now, liability immunity was also something that Andrew Cuomo sneaked into law in New York State, totally under the radar. Most of the legislators had no idea that this law that was written by the nursing home, you know, his donors by the nursing home industry. Talk about Andrew Cuomo's record on coronavirus. And it isn't the one that he touted.
No, it certainly wasn't. And that's one of the reasons I included him in the book. I think it's very important that we recognize that while a lot of the failures and a lot of the deliberate wrongdoing can be pinned on Republicans, there were also Democrats who failed us during this period. And in fact, did so for many of the same reasons as the Republicans, because of their ties to special interests, because of their self-serving approach to politics and to governance. And Andrew Cuomo was a clear example of that. Now, early on in the pandemic, he was something of a hero because Trump's response was so chaotic, so deliberately dishonest and dysfunctional that people really were desperate just to get basic information. And Cuomo filled that role by holding daily press conferences. He seemed decisive. He was doing things. He was making demands. He was providing a lot of information. And I will give him the credit that much of that was useful. But at the same time, Cuomo was making wrongheaded decisions. One of them was to have people who had tested positive for the virus and who were in a hospital situation be allowed to be sent back to or put in nursing homes. Now, when you did that, you introduced the virus to nursing homes and you had, you know, a tremendous amount of infections and deaths that were simply unnecessary. So Cuomo screwed up there. And it was, you know, in a very chaotic, very difficult situation. He was not the only political figure who messed up in this way. But what's striking about Cuomo was that he lied about it. Once it became clear that you know, they had made a terrible error, or perhaps that they had failed in the level of due diligence that was necessary, he lied about it. He threatened to punish legislators like Ron Kim and others who wanted to not only expose the truth, but deal with the issue. And as you note, and this is the most nefarious aspect of it, or at least one of the most nefarious aspects, he did indeed promote a liability shield for the healthcare industry and for others that prevented families and individuals from seeking accountability when people died unnecessarily, people got sick unnecessarily, people lacked the care that they needed because healthcare personnel became very, very sick. And really, at the end of the day, Cuomo comes out as far less of a hero than he certainly tried to present himself as. And in very many instances, an example of the sort of corrupted and dysfunctional politician that made a pandemic that was bad far worse.
Yeah, in fact, The Atlantic pointed out, and this is even above and beyond the nursing home thing, pointed out that he could be responsible for 15,000 excess deaths due to COVID because of his going into a snit over Mayor Bill de Blasio trying to shut down, and Cuomo said, you know, nobody else gets to shut down New York City, just me. But talk about a little bit more about the corruption here, his ties to the hospital industry, his ties to the nursing home industry. You know, this liability shield was written by the nursing home industry, as you point out in the book, John Nichols, in Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers. And it had to be undone by a separate act by the legislature later on.
Look, Andrew Cuomo was a massive recipient of funding from special interests. I mean, he built up a huge, huge campaign funds. It's one of the reasons why he was able to get elected and reelected regularly in New York State. And in fact, when he faced serious primary challenges from Zephyr Teachout at one point, from Cynthia Nixon in another race, I mean, he collected massive amounts of money from many of the same special interests that fund Republicans. And that includes key interests in healthcare, nursing homes, et cetera. This money was very important to him politically. And so there is very little doubt that he served the interests of those industries that provided tremendous amounts of funding to his campaigns, either through PAC contributions or direct contributions from CEOs and investors and others. And the liability shield was clearly an example of that. It was not necessary. It did make it harder to hold wrongdoers and inept players to account. And as you point out, Cuomo resisted efforts to lift the liability shield and to get rid of it, even after his failures and his wrongdoing were exposed. And it was a really brutal battle. And there were heroes in that. Folks like Ron Kim, a Democratic legislator from Queens, who was initially supportive of a lot of what Cuomo was doing, and then recognized that his own constituents, many of them immigrants, were getting sick and dying, and their lives were being lost unnecessarily. And so Ron Kim stepped out as a real heroic figure and said, you know, no, we've got to push back. We've got to change what we've done. We've got to protect people. And for this, he was directly threatened by Andrew Cuomo, you know, literally threatened to ruin him politically. And yet Ron Kim and others pursued this fight, and they ultimately did prevail. It was one of the great undertold stories of the pandemic that there, you know, I point to a lot of elected officials and a lot of political players who are very, very damaging, very, very, you know, destructive. But there are indeed heroes in this story. And Ron Kim and some of the other progressive Democrats in New York really did come out as the people we needed in positions of public power when they were there. And I do try in the book, look, primarily to talk about those who need to be held to account, but also to recognize those who did demand a measure of accountability at key stages during the pandemic.
Yes, but unfortunately, the accountability for the nursing home scandal, I don't think Cuomo's ever really actually faced
no.
that.
No, he resigned office, and he resigned office, you know, primarily because of attention to his personal foibles and his wrongdoing and his treatment of women who worked for him. But there's still an area of accountability that I think has been left unaddressed. And really, Francesca, that's a pattern throughout the book, that we have too much of a tendency to take the information that we've, you know, finally gotten together on who failed us, who did wrong during this pandemic period, and apply it. And so as a result, we see all sorts of political figures kind of walk away or even obscure the reality of what they did. And Andrew Cuomo, I think, is one of the best examples of that.
John Nichols. Stay tuned for more of our conversation after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for our free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. And find us on Facebook at Writer's Voice Radio or Twitter at Writer's Voice. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love on your podcast app. It really helps others to find the show. We're spending the hour today talking with Nation correspondent and author John Nichols about his new book, Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers. Let's get back to our conversation. In the book also, I think we've mentioned it, I mean, this kind of free market run amok. Elaine Chao, coincidentally, the wife of Mitch McConnell, was transportation secretary under the Trump regime. And her approach to protecting transportation workers, I just want to quote, you quote her in the book. She says, regulations have to remain cost justified and narrowly tailored to address an identified market failure. Deconstruct that quote for us, and what does it really mean?
Well, it's not hard to deconstruct. It basically translates to we're going to do whatever the corporations tell us to do. And we're going to do whatever the industries tell us to do. We're not going to step up in an emergency moment and rise to the occasion. And that's exactly, you know, how Elaine Chao, as Secretary of Transportation, played it. In the book, I tell the story of a bus driver in the Seattle area, which was the first hotspot in the United States for the pandemic, who as early as February of 2020 was writing essays for his union website in which he was saying, look, we're not protected. These buses are the equivalent of rolling cruise ships, you know, because when we had all these cases where the virus spread so quickly through the cruise ships. And he was saying, you know, look, people get on these buses. Sometimes they're going to hospitals because they feel sick. And we, you know, take their money or we, you know, check their passes. They walk right up to us. We're interacting with them in all these settings. We need protective gear. And we need, you know, screens to protect the drivers. We need all sorts of other, you know, interactions, which are easily done. And there was no action. The Department of Transportation did not intervene. Frankly, a lot of, you know, transportation companies did not intervene. And this is not just on buses, but subways, you know, ferries, airplanes, you just run down the list. And there was an enormous level of death among, you know, train conductors and bus drivers and flight attendants and others, including the driver I mentioned. He died, you know, early on in the pandemic, even after warning about the threat. And as the stories began to pile up, there were passionate pleas to Elaine Chao from transportation workers, from their unions, from public interest and passenger rights groups, from public health professionals, academics. Everybody was pleading with her to do a national mask mandate for public transportation, to just put some basic protections in place and assure that you know, not just, you know, transit workers, but also the passengers would be protected. And she never did it. She refused at every turn, even as the volume got turned up and, you know, there were petitions to her, she resisted. And this is the pattern with Elaine Chao. Every time she's been in a cabinet position, she has invariably sided with industry against the public interest, against public health and public safety. And the result here was that you had a tremendous level of unnecessary death among transit workers and, frankly, among people who use public transit. It simply didn't have to happen. And that's on Elaine Chao. And she knew exactly what she should have done. And she exactly refused to do it.
John Nichols, in this book, in Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers, you point to, I think, what you could generally say is an identified market failure in general in this country, and that was the offshoring of the production of vital medical equipment, not just ventilators, but simple things like masks as well. And that goes way back. In fact, it goes back to the Obama administration partially. It certainly goes even further back than that in terms of the gutting of our public health system. But you have a chapter about Rahm Emanuel. So tell us about What role did he play in exacerbating the systemic problems, this huge market failure?
Yeah, Rahm Emanuel is a permanent fixture in Democratic administrations going back, you know, better part of 30 years. He was a key player in Bill Clinton's administration. He was a key player in Barack Obama's administration. He's been angling for an ambassadorship in Joe Biden's administration. And when Rahm Emanuel was in both the Clinton and the Obama administrations, his kind of primary advocacy was for neoliberal economics, and particularly for free trade deals that made it easier for corporations to offshore jobs and manufacturing. And, you know, of course, like all supporters of free trade, he claimed it was going to be good for everybody and, you know, rising, you know, tide will lift all boats. But the reality was it was bad for workers in the U.S. and in many cases for workers in the countries that we trade with. It was bad for the environment. It was bad for, you know, basic small d democratic protections. And yet he absolutely and rigidly continued to advance these free trade dogmas and was very, very successful at it with NAFTA, with the GATT agreement, with most favored nation trading status for China, with a series of agreements under Barack Obama. And so at the end of the day, you really can pin a lot of the free trade orthodoxy, if you will, on Rahm Emanuel. So then fast forward to the pandemic. By the time the pandemic hit, as Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio, pointed out to me when I interviewed him, many of the core industries that we needed simply weren't in the United States anymore. We had offshored not just jobs and factories, but whole industries. And that was clearly true in a lot of the medical gear, protective gear areas. It was, you know, the production had been shipped off to distant lands where it was much cheaper to make things, but that had been done without any sort of planning or preparation. And so as a result, when the pandemic hit, we simply were not prepared. And we hadn't done the sort of planning that other countries do. Countries around the world embrace something referred to as industrial policy. And that is that at the governing level, they determine what industries they need to protect, that they need to maintain. And at the top of the list, invariably, is you know, companies that do and jobs that do production that serves our medical services, our protective gear, our medical technology, all this. And why do you do that? Because you want to be ready for an emergency situation. You want to be ready for potentially a pandemic. You don't want to have to be searching around the world trying to find the masks and the other products that you need. And we just didn't do that. And you can clearly connect it to the way in which we did free trade policy, the way in which we rejected industrial policy in the United States. And if you want to identify an individual who is perhaps most passionate about it, it's Rahm Emanuel. Now, he happens to be a Democrat, and he had plenty of Republican allies in this regard. But the bottom line is that because Democrats historically have been a little closer to the labor movement, have been many grassroots Democrats much more critical of free trade, the role that Rahm Emanuel played in promoting free trade and in rejecting industrial policy becomes an especially damaging one as regards the pandemic. And so that's why I wrote a good deal about him.
You write, I want to quote you here, John Nichols, in Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers. You write that it's not just capitalism that's a problem, although the pandemic certainly revealed a great many flaws in the theory that the market can resolve societal challenges. It's the way in which capitalism works in a country like the United States with its cronyism, corruption, racketeering, lack of oversight, and open invitations to the sort of cozy deal-making that well serves corporations but ill serves humanity. And you take as your example one of the corporate coronavirus criminals in the book, Pfizer. Talk about the cronyism, the corruption, the lack of oversight that Pfizer had.
Pfizer stands out. They just recently announced that in 2021, as they brought their vaccine onto the market, that their revenues doubled. Now, that's a pretty big deal. Very few companies that are long established see their revenues double in 1 year. And of that doubling of revenues, overwhelmingly, They were advantaged by the massive profits they made off their vaccine. In fact, they made over $20 billion in profit. Oxfam has estimated that Pfizer's been making $1 million an hour every hour of every day in profit from the vaccine since it came online. Now, an awful lot of people are going to say, wow, that's, you know, it's pretty amazing. It's jaw-dropping. It's excessive. But, you know, we're glad we got the vaccines. And I certainly am. I'm glad to have been vaccinated and got my booster and all that. But what we have to recognize is that that Pfizer didn't really do that much in this regard. Neither did the other pharmaceutical companies. They benefited from a tremendous amount of research that was being done at the international level with shared DNA, shared information, with a, you know, kind of an urgent effort to make sure that we develop vaccines. And the pharmaceutical companies took advantage of that, as they should have. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. But in taking advantage of all this government research and of all the research and work done by health groups around the world, they didn't sacrifice anything. They didn't say, well, you know, look, you know, we want to do a public service here. Not at all. They said, we want to make massive profits. And in the case of Pfizer, they actually opted out of some of the caps on profiteering so that they could make even more. And when they brought their vaccines online, they were the first to get out. They got massive contracts that paid them incredible levels of money per dose. And they got deals to, you know, maintain those contracts over time to keep selling the vaccines. End result is that Pfizer ended up with, you know, an incredible improvement in its financial situation. In fact, at one point, there was an estimate that Pfizer, Moderna, and BioNTech, those three companies, were making $1,000 a second, $65,000 a minute, and $93 million a day in revenues as a result of the vaccines, right? So just massive amounts of money pouring into these companies. And while Moderna ultimately accepted, you know, some level of responsibility for the rest of the world, Pfizer has continued to refuse and, in fact, openly battle against efforts to have them share their vaccine recipes and technology with other countries and with other producers so that we can get vaccines to the most vulnerable people in the world. So I guess the classic thing with Pfizer is they benefited off research done by governments and support from governments and huge contracts, and yet they're willing to do nothing or very, very little in order to really fight the spread of the disease internationally.
Why fight the disease if it's the source of your profits?
Yeah, but I don't even think, and I understand that concept, but I don't even think it's that, I don't think it's that nefarious. I think that that Pfizer, if you paid them enough, they'd be glad to do whatever. And, you know, vaccines are not really, the weird thing about it, Francesca, is I learned in doing this research that vaccines aren't something that pharmaceutical companies like to do. They like to make drugs that you have to take every day, right? And so they require a lot of incentives to go into the area of vaccines, and they got them. And in this case, I think that the real culprit here is not just the pharmaceutical companies, but also many governments around the world, which see the pharmaceutical industry as, you know, like their equivalent of their auto industry or their equivalent of some other industry. And so they protect it in ways that prevent the sharing of breakthrough medicines and breakthrough protections. And so as a result, we end up in a situation where there's an intersection of commerce, governing and need, public need, that invariably ends up making the pharmaceutical companies dramatically richer. It's a systemic problem, and it's one that was exposed incredibly well, incredibly jarringly during the pandemic. And it's something that we need to address. And if I can just add one final note in this regard, you know, during World War II, which is not an exact equivalent by any means, but was a crisis situation where we were all asked to pull together. The defense industries were told, you cannot make excessive profits. Franklin Roosevelt and others said that, you know, any profits that you make above what you would regularly have made before the war, we're going to tax you at a rate of up to 90%. And so that just simply wasn't allowed. And yet in this pandemic circumstance, we have allowed the pharmaceutical companies to make, you know, excessive profits and have done very, very little to hold them to account.
Then another whole group that has made excessive profits have been billionaires in general. You have a terrific chapter on, well, they're all great, but on Jeff Bezos of Amazon. But actually, before even just talking about him, I want to quote you again. You say the $1 trillion wealth gain by 651 billionaires in the first 9 months of the pandemic shutdown was more than it would cost to send a stimulus check of $3,000 to everyone of, you know, 330 million people in America. A family of four would receive over $12,000. So that's the context. It's not just what they've made, but what everybody else has suffered as a result. So now tell us about Jeff Bezos.
Sure. Well, yeah, and I think you're right to put Bezos in the context of the billionaire class. And, you know, obviously he is, along with Elon Musk, in competition to become the first trillionaire. And that's one of the sort of shocking sort of things that occurred during the pandemic. These billionaires were making so much money that it actually opened up a speculation about who would be the first trillionaire, because they had kind of crossed the line of just being, you know, multiple billions into hundreds of billions. And obviously in a relatively short amount of time, in fact, with Bezos, some people predicting as soon as 2026, you could cross that trillionaire line. And we ask, you know, how do you make this kind of money in a pandemic? I thought everybody was supposed to be sharing in the sacrifice. I thought, you know, we have, I mean, all this economic turbulence. Well, in the case of Bezos, he obviously had an industry or had a corporation that was well-positioned. People were going to need to have things delivered to them. And that's understandable. And you know, sometimes, you know, in a capitalist system, you end up being in a good position to make money. But it wasn't just that. Early on in the pandemic, Amazon fired whistleblowers who said that their plants, their warehouses were unsafe, and who specifically pointed out that people were getting sick and potentially dying because of a lack of protection. And so right off the bat, you see that it isn't just being in the right place at the right time. It is also manipulating your operations in ways that harm workers to the advantage of your own bottom line. And that just played out through 2020, 2021, as workers at Amazon sought to unionize down in Alabama, and Amazon pulled out all the stops to keep a union out and have continued to do so, despite the fact that we know from, you know, clearly quantifiable evidence that having union representation is tremendously beneficial in a pandemic moment. It allows you to raise concerns and you know, to even to walk out if indeed there's a lack of sufficient protection. And so Amazon was a bad player and was very secretive about sicknesses and deaths at their warehouses, continues to be so. And so that I focused on Bezos a lot in that regard. And I also focused on him for one other reason. You know, he made tens of billions of dollars during this pandemic. And you know, what did he do with it? Certainly he did some charity and you give him credit for that. But he also spent it, you know, flying off into outer space, right? And you know, doing these incredibly, you know, self-aggrandizing moves at a time when we were asking nurses to go into hospitals without adequate protective gear. It was a stark example of the reality of pandemic profiteering at a time when working class people were sacrificing. And if I can give you one final element on the billionaire class, you quoted very well from, you know, what I wrote in the book. It's notable that as time moved on, we now know that the billionaire class in the United States has, which started the pandemic with about $3 trillion in assets, now has about $5 trillion. So their wealth has increased by $2 trillion, probably more as of today, during the course of the pandemic. That's one of the most exponential increases in the wealth of the elites in the history of the world. I mean, it's just stark and overwhelming. And again, I'll go back to that World War II example. Under Franklin Roosevelt, during World War II, they established a top marginal tax rate of 95%. And so they said, look, you know, if you bring in, you know, $10 billion, you're going to have to give us 9.5 trillion of that, right? We're going to expect, you know, an overwhelming portion of that to come back to the people, because it's not acceptable for you to have massive profits in massive increases in your wealth during the course of a pandemic. And that is something that is still open for discussion. And frankly, it's interesting, as I've mentioned this, that during World War II, there was a 95% top marginal rate on the wealthy. I've gotten very little pushback from folks. Talking to people across the country in all sorts of events, what I've heard is, or seen, is a lot of nodding of heads and even a few amens along the way.
The subtitle for this book, John Nichols, For Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers, is Accountability for Those Who Caused the Crisis. It's a blistering indictment of them. Now, what would accountability look like?
That's a very good question. And I wrestle with that a lot in the book, because I'm not here to preach punishment. You know, I understand the value of forgiveness, and I understand the point of, moving forward. But without accountability, we can't achieve change. And so accountability becomes necessary, not just in the individual instances of excessive and deep wrongdoing, but also in the broader sense societally. So what I say is, where we find evidence of wrongdoing, there is not just the opportunity, but the necessity of criminal, civil, and congressional action. And that can take many, many different forms. But one of the things that I write about in the book is what happened during the Great Depression. You know, too often we see crises as sort of natural phenomenon, you know, that you can't do anything to impact. Well, during the Great Depression, which was incredibly devastating to the great mass of Americans, initially under Herbert Hoover, there was a very lax response. But when Franklin Roosevelt came to power, there was a much more aggressive response, that of the New Deal. And it's sort of a little bit lost to history that a big part of the New Deal was accountability. And there was a clear effort to identify wrongdoers, to, you know, point a finger of blame at those who made the financial crisis worse than it needed to be, and to hold them account criminally, through civil actions, through fines. And ultimately, that was done also to advance the cause of regulation, so that we could regulate the banks and the financial industries, so that we would never get in a similar situation again, where they could take advantage of an economically turbulent moment and enrich themselves while the great mass of people were, you know, dramatically harmed, both economically and, you know, basically in their ability to survive. And so we saw that during the Great Depression. It was very effective. They had something called the Pecora Commission, which was an investigatory operation run by a prosecutor from New York named Ferdinand Pecora, who had prosecuted mobsters back in the 1920s. And he brought in the top bankers, the top investors in the U.S., grilled them under oath. He referred to it as Wall Street under oath. And out of that grew criminal, civil, and congressional action of the sort that I would suggest is necessary today. And I would also add one final note. It's important to recognize that Donald Trump was impeached for two, deep instances of wrongdoing. But I think it would be totally appropriate, it would have been totally appropriate to impeach Donald Trump for his lies about the pandemic. That's completely within the context and within the appropriate use of the impeachment power. And parallel to that, I would also say that that could apply to many other members of this administration. And a final element, taxation is also a form of accountability. And that's something we can do today. We should establish a top marginal tax on the billionaire class, so that as they continue to reap massive benefits during this lingering pandemic, we claw some of that back to pay for healthcare, to pay for human needs. And we should also tax excessive profits for corporations, including the pharmaceutical corporations.
Well, John Nichols, this book, Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers, is such a huge step forward, I think, toward that accountability. Of course, it's up now to the rest of us to press the case. And this is the book to help us do it. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here. It's a terrific book. It's a terrific read. There are many, many more examples than we've had time to even discuss here. And I want to thank you so much for once again coming on to the show and talking with us about this book.
Francesca, thanks for having me. Writer's Voice is one of the great pleasures for me when I write a book, because coming to talk with you, I know I'll be talking with somebody who's dug deep into the book and thought about it a lot. And there's no author who doesn't appreciate that.
Oh, that's great. Can I quote you?
Absolutely. I would hope that you would.
That was John Nichols, correspondent for The Nation and author of numerous books. Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers is out from Penguin Random House. And speaking of Penguin Random House, the publishers created a Banned Books Resources Hub that includes tools, materials, and information that can help people and organizations fighting book bans. The hub also has a contact form for reporting new cases of challenges or bans of Penguin Random House titles. Go to writersvoice.net for a link. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Andy Bowman about his book, The West Texas Power Plant That Saved the World: Energy, Capitalism, and Climate Change. It's about a small power plant in Pecos County, Texas, that became a test case for renewable energy in the U.S. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @WritersVoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.